Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Monday, March 21st, 2022. The South Sudan government denies UN Human Rights Report accusing South Sudan People's Defense Forces of raping women across the country.
This is a normal story that is sung all the time. This is actually nothing other than people who have decided to tarnish the image of the government of South Sudan.
And authorities in South Sudan's Warap state embark on an exercise to take guns away from the hands of civilians.
The governor of Warap state has been preaching about the disarmament, and also the communities have agreed to hand the guns to the concerned authorities.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in South Sudan have dismissed a new report by the United Nations Human Rights Commission, which accused armed groups in the country of continuing to use rape against women and girls as a military tactic. The report released Monday says some women in the country are often raped at gunpoint. But South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makuei says such reports are meant only to tarnish the image of the government. Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
The United Nations Human Rights Commission on South Sudan reports that widespread sexual violence was carried out by all armed groups in the country between January and December 2021. Addressing the 49th regular session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva on Monday, Yasmin Soka, chairperson of the UN Commission, said it is, quote, outrageous and completely unacceptable that women's bodies are systematically used on the scale as the spoils of war, end quote. The commission was established by the UN Human Rights Council with a mandate to investigate the human rights situation in South Sudan and to report facts in relation to violations of human rights. Soka says South Sudanese men must stop regarding female bodies as territory to be owned, controlled, and exploited. Major General Luruai Kong, a spokesperson for the South Sudan's People's Defense Forces, declined to comment on the report, referring South Sudan in Focus to the government. Information Minister Michael Makuei Lueth called the report nothing new.
This is a normal story that is sung all the time. This is actually nothing other than people who have decided to tarnish the image of the government of South Sudan.
Makuei says rape cases are carried out by individuals who should be held accountable for their wrongdoing and not the government as a whole.
If a soldier, an individual, decides to rape a woman or to commit an offense of rape, is it the responsibility of the government? There is what we call the judiciary of the Republic of South Sudan. It is the judiciary which is responsible for all that, not any other person.
Makuei says nobody is above the law and advise rape survivors to file their cases with the court. SPLA-IO spokesperson Colonel Lampol Gabriel says the report is too general and does not specify which armed groups have sexually abused women and girls.
There are very many armed groups here. For me to answer, you need to point fingers at SPLA-IO and say, your forces did ABC in this location, and trust me, I will answer you. Because when we talk of arms group, we even have the youth that are armed. We have the cattle herders that are armed.
The report by the UN Human Rights Commission says the South Sudan government has a role to play in ending impunity for serious sexual crimes committed in the country. It says the 2018 Revised Peace Agreement, which includes provisions for security sector reforms and judicial system reforms, are some of the best ways to end sexual violence if those provisions are fully implemented. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and 102 humanitarian and developmental agencies are asking for $1.2 billion to help 2.3 million South Sudanese refugees and communities sheltering in five countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Nearly 4 million South Sudanese have fled nearly a decade of civil war and a peace deal that has not yet come to fruition. They are either still in that country or have become refugees in neighboring countries. The South Sudanese refugee crisis is Africa's largest, and the response to it is one of the least funded humanitarian operations. An estimated 2.3 million people have fled to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda. While praising their generosity, UN refugee spokesman Matthew Saltmarsh says those countries are poor, suffer from many of the same problems as does South Sudan, and can ill afford to care for the masses of impoverished refugees.
South Sudan continues to grapple with sporadic violence, chronic food insecurity, and the devastating impact of major flooding. The COVID-19 pandemic has also strained people's resources. Asylum countries are facing similar challenges from the climate crisis and the pandemic, but have continued to keep their doors open for refugees.
Saltmarsh says the host countries need support to provide food, shelter, and essential services such as education and health care. The United Nations says women and girls in South Sudan are subject to gender-based violence, rape, and conflict-related sexual violence. Saltmarsh says the UNHCR and partners will scale up programs to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. They will provide mental health and psychosocial support to victims of abuse.
This follows a worrying rise in reports of depression over the last year, especially among refugees in Kenya and Uganda. It remains, of course, as you know, a children's crisis, with 2 out of 3 South Sudanese refugees being under the age of 18. Funding is required for child protection, including to ensure proper birth registration and family reunification.
Saltmarsh acknowledges competition for scarce resources is fierce. He notes the international focus in response to the war in Ukraine is overwhelming. He says that is appropriate given the enormity of the crisis. However, he says the plight of the South Sudanese refugees must not be forgotten. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on conflict, experts warn the conflict in Ukraine could increase hunger and food insecurity for some people in Africa. Most African countries import wheat and vegetable oil from Ukraine and Russia, a region engulfed in conflict since Russia invaded its neighbor. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
African families are feeling the pinch as prices of essential commodities increase due to persistent drought, the coronavirus pandemic, and now the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The United Nations says Russia and Ukraine produce 53% of the world's sunflowers and seeds and 27% of the world's wheat. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development figures show Africa imported wheat from the two countries worth $5.1 billion between 2018-2020. The study shows at least 25 African countries import a third of their wheat from Russia and Ukraine, and 15 of them import more than half from those two countries. Kenya is one of the African countries affected by the global food price increase. The head of policy research and advocacy at the Kenya Association of Manufacturers, Job Wanjohi, says the cost of importing wheat to the country has increased by 33%.
The cost of wheat per ton, of which Kenya is heavily dependent on Russia and Ukraine, has increased to $460 per ton. Before, it was $345 per ton. And the landed cost in Nairobi is likely to increase now from $500 to $550 per ton, around there. So you see the Ukraine-Russian war is aggravating the situation as food. The food security in the country is concerned.
Vegetable oil prices have also increased. Malaysia and Indonesia account for 85% of global crude palm oil exports. Malaysian authorities warned this week the price of palm oil could reach $2,200 a ton and is expected to remain that way until the third quarter of the year. Peter Kamelingen is the head of Pan-Africa at the charity Oxfam International. He says Africa is more vulnerable to food insecurity.
Relying on global food chains only means that you're going to be more vulnerable. For a long time, Oxfam has said that what we need is actually to invest in small farmers, making them more resilient, bringing technologies that are responsive to their, that are sensitive and responsive to their unique needs. Small food producers are still the most important. And I think our agricultural policies, our extension services, our national budget investments have not been focused on this. Food sovereignty means producing as much food as possible within the country, if not within the country, at least within the region.
He also says African governments are not investing enough in their communities.
Governments in our part of the world have had to go into increasing problems of debt in some of the economies in the region. For every 10 shillings of the national budget, probably 7 is going to repaying debt. That also means that governments are not investing in social services, in health, in water, in education, so that burden is being transferred to the household. And most of those people in the household, it simply means women and children, are the ones who are bearing that burden.
The UN's International Fund for Agricultural Development warns that the ongoing war in Ukraine will escalate global hunger and poverty. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, some Sudanese in the diaspora express their views on Sudan-Russia relations. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
name something that you haven't tried but hope to someday.
I never drive a car, but I hoped to, because I've grown in a poor background, and in my life I desire to do so.
I want to travel from Uganda to different country because I've never moved out of Uganda. Yes.
I've never tried bungee jumping, but I would like to try it one time.
I've not tried paragliding before, but I would like to try it someday, being at the top of the mountain, jumping and flying in the sky like a bird.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Some Sudanese living in the United States and back home are adding their voices about their country's relations with Russia after a recent high-level visit of Sudanese officials to Moscow. Many Sudanese have condemned reports of gold deals between Sudan and Russian Wagner Group, as well as potential deal to establish a Russian naval base in Sudan. For analysis on this, Nabil Biaju reached out to a Khartoum-based political analyst for more.
Khartoum-based political analyst Haj Hamad says since Sudan's independence, military rulers in Khartoum have always turned to Moscow for military support when relations with the West became strained.
Russian-Sudanese relations started during the first military rule of Abdut, when he started to bring in to buy and purchase their weapons from Eastern Europe. That time it was the Soviet Union. And you can say since that time, most of the National Army weaponry are coming from that part of Israel. So in fact, the relation is always, and has been always, strong with the military. Even during the Soviet system, when you remember the coup by the communists done by Hashim al-Ata, it was under the military regime. It was a military regime. So you can see in all different regimes in Sudan, Russia was defending its interests as pro-military regime.
Hamad says Russian President Vladimir Putin had good relations with former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, and since the military coup in October 2021, which halted the civilian-led transitional government in Sudan, Russia has been supporting the coup leaders.
Now, even with the coming of Putin, another totalitarian system in Russia, and even civil feather fly together. They are the same, the two faces of one coup. They continue even during al-Bashir time. You remember that the Western relations with al-Bashir regime was in fact, in very bad times, and this made him even drunk. So embarrassing that he went to Russia and he sat near the boots of Putin, requesting that he should be protected by the Americans. Verily, in fact, the one glimpse of support were.
Hamad says reliable reports show that Moscow is smuggling gold from Sudan through military-connected companies and companies linked to paramilitary commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who is also the deputy head of Sudan's sovereign council.
Most of the gold in Sudan is artesian mine gold from Western Sudan, and these military army companies are getting gold also from Northern Sudan. And both are sending it to Russia to ensure a continuous military support.
Hamad says Russia's war in Ukraine has put a strain on Sudan's economy because of significant reductions in wheat imports, which Sudan used to get from both Russia and Ukraine. He says Sudan's military rulers cannot receive much military assistance from Russia at the moment due to Putin's occupation with the war in Ukraine.
The Russians cannot in such kind of a situation to give them even ammunition. They cannot give them because they need military hardware for their own military adventure. This is one. Number two, the only economic support, which is is being curtailed also by the war. Thirdly, Ukraine itself was the main source of purchased wheat for Sudan.
Dozens of Sudanese Americans gathered outside the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. on Saturday to denounce Russian aggression in Ukraine and its involvement in Sudan. Here are some of the voices of Sudanese in D.C.
I'm Saigo Brian, and I came from Maryland. And we are here because we oppose to the deal between Hamiti and Putin. And we need to stop all wars in the world, and especially the to get our sovereign country back.
My name is Isam Mustafa from New York City. I came this morning around 6 o'clock to demonstrate with my fellow Sudanese American here, to demonstrate in front of the Russian embassy. Again, it's a visit of Hamiti. He's one of the militia, the Janjaweed leader, is ruling Sudan right now. We came here to denounce his visit to Russia that happened on February 27. During that visit, he pledged to Russians that they will have a military base in Sudan, one of our shores. He also smuggled a lot of gold to them, and he also told our representative in the United Nations not to side with Ukraine and to abstain from voting. And Sudan is the first time abstain from denouncing invasion to any from one country to another. This is because of the militia and the army that ruled Sudan at this time. We came here to denounce Putin, affiliation with the Janjaweed and our military coup government that rules Sudan right now. That's why we're here today.
My name is Dr. Salah Hussein. I came from Burkina. I have been in this area for the last over 10 or 15 years. And I came here just to voice my concern about what's going on in Sudan regarding the latest visit of Hamiti to Russia, whereby he is smuggling a lot of gold so that Putin could sustain the expected sanctions.
For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Authorities in Warrap State say they have started a disarmament exercise across the state to address intercommunal violence in the area. The Minister of Information in Warrap State says The forces conducting the exercise have been instructed to use force against those who will resist the disarmament. Dengai Deng reports for VOA from Juba.
Warafi State Information Minister Ring Deng Ading says Governor Lewa Yeng presided over the disarmament exercise in Tone South County yesterday. Ading says the disarmament campaign will be carried out across the state to stop ongoing intercommunal violence.
Since last year up to now, so the governor of Warab State has been preaching about the disarmament, and also the communities have agreed to hand the guns to the concerned authorities in a peaceful manner, that they should disarm these civilians in order to avail peace in the state.
Ading says state officials gave communities ample time to peacefully hand over their weapons to authorities, but there was little response to their call. He says the forces conducting the disarmament campaign have been instructed to use force against any civilians who try to resist handing over their arms.
I'm urging all the citizens, the civilians of Warab State, to give out the guns so that we remain in peace. When we say it is peaceful, it is when people voluntarily give their guns, and then later on whoever is found hiding his gun, so that will be the case, that will be his case with the soldier.
Warab State Twitch County resident Samuel Yai says he welcomes the exercise because it will help reduce rampant gun violence in the state. But he says he worries about the way guns have returned to the hands of civilians after similar exercises in the past.
In every community, you may find that each and every youth is having a gun. Even someone who has never gone to a military barrack, which is not good. Disarmament can be conducted, yes. My question is, what about after it has finished? Is it going to be the last, or will the people remain still in the peace? That is the question goes with my worry. And if so, this is not the first time. It may come in the same channel. And what if it came into the same channel later on, it will also be another problem.
A Wilson Santino Ding, a resident of Goryal in Warab State, says disarming only one state or community will not restore peace because it will leave disarmed communities vulnerable to neighboring communities that remain armed. Ding says the government of South Sudan should carry out a general disarmament campaign nationwide.
We don't want violence. We want peace. Now the people of Warab will be disarmed. Okay, we agreed, but we have our neighbors, like the people of Northern Liège in Unity State, and they have problem with us. Also the people of Abyei Administrative Area, also the Misraya have been attacking us from the Sudan. What shall we do? This is why I think the way disarmament being done is not good and cannot bring the real peace.
At least 80 people were killed and more than 90 others injured in 2020 when South Sudan People's Defense Forces, who were carrying out a disarmament exercise, clashed with civilians who resisted the campaign in Warab State's Tone East County. The South Sudan National Network on Small Arms criticized the government's handling of the exercise, saying officials should have included plans to prevent clashes between armed youth and soldiers. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Kenya and other member states of the Regional Center on Small Arms and Light Weapons met today in the Kenyan capital. They will evaluate progress made since the signing of the Nairobi Declaration to curb the flow of illicit weapons in the Great Lakes region and the Horn of Africa. A report by Amnesty International says the United Nations arms embargo in the region continues to be broken as the implementation of critical security, governance, and accountability arrangements are delayed. Maureen Odhiambo reports for VOA from Nairobi.
It's been over two decades since the declaration was signed, and the sale of illicit weapons continues to fuel violence in many countries in the region, including Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Somalia. Today's meeting comes at a time when the East Africa is experiencing inflows of small arms from Yemen through Somalia. Arms heading for Libya are also flowing through Sudan and South Sudan and finding their ways as well to Kenya and Uganda. Security analyst Mustafa Ali says weapons often find their way into multiple countries because of lack of border controls.
There has always been a challenge of small arms and light weapons in the Horn of Africa region. The place is awash with illegal arms, particularly the AK-47 and pistols. The reason for that has been the conflict in the region. One of the ways to address the availability of small arms and light weapons is to carefully look at the supply and demand sides. Why is it that communities want to own these weapons? Then it becomes easier to address the challenge.
An earlier investigation by Amnesty International in the Horn of Africa revealed the presence of newly imported small arms and ammunition and the diversion of armored vehicles for military use which have not been approved under the transfer license. As the meeting aims at establishing the milestones achieved so far, East African countries are experiencing military coups, armed struggles, violent crime, extremism, and community conflict.
The Horn of Africa is sandwiched by conflict systems of the Sahel region, where terrorist groups, where traffickers, criminal groups are always having these weapons and are supplying and trafficking these weapons. To really reduce the availability of these small arms, there is need to address conflicts and violence and wars in the surrounding areas, the countries that are in vicious cycles of conflict.
The Kenyan government is on high alert to ensure there are no flows of illicit arms into the country from Mozambique, South Sudan, Somalia, and Ethiopia. At the moment, the country is facing community fights in the counties of West Pokot, Baringo, and Elgeyo Marakwet. This as the government grapples to cool the conflict that has been sustained through the sale of illicit weapons. Last year, President Uhuru Kenyatta presided over the banning of more than 5,000 illegal firearms in Kenya.
And I therefore call upon all our citizens who may in any way and for whatever reason be in possession of illegal firearms to submit the weapons to our authorities under the cover of the amnesty for illegal possession of firearms. An illegal gun makes you less safe, not more safe.
The Nairobi Declaration on Small Arms is a legally binding instrument whose aim was to encourage collaboration against corruption linked to illicit manufacturing, trafficking, as well as illicit possession and use of small arms and light weapons. However, early last year, Kenya launched a gun manufacturing company in what the president described as the beginning of the country's plans to become a significant weapons manufacturer. Kenya has invested $37 million in the manufacturing company for small arms, saying that sourcing from foreign market is expensive, though analysts are concerned the move could increase conflict in East Africa and the Horn. Reporting for Viewers, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now end the show with Victoria Ole and the song Mama.
Shukran.
We've been listening to Victoria Ole and the song Mama. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your home, phone, and vehicle. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Kuruju mafi, bakara mafi, gideda mafi, shokola mafi, mehia mafi, kuluhaja mafi, 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 kuluhaja.